Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening. Good morning for me. Can you hear me well? Yeah? Okay. Well, thank you very much for being here tonight and for supporting me and all the other priests in training. And thank you, Les, for offering us the opportunity to say something. I miss seeing you and sitting with all of you. And I would like to start tonight by remembering and honoring George Floyd, who was killed under a police car, as you all know, last week in Minneapolis. The video showing a police with a knee on his neck for nearly 9 minutes while he's repeatedly saying that he cannot breathe and calling for his mother is devastating and heartbreaking. And it was really painful for me to see the lack of compassion and the acknowledgement of our shared humanity that led to his death. Seeing the images of the massive protests and the riots across the country made me reflect about my life in the US and my journey to become an American citizen. I came to the US, I arrived to the US in the summer of 1999. I was working at the time for a financial newspaper in Madrid that had a partnership with the Wall Street Journal. And I was offered a job with the journal in New York. My role at the time was to produce a 4-page daily edition for the Spanish paper, adapting content published by the Wall Street Journal for a Spanish audience. And it was a dream job, a dream city, an American dream. I worked downtown Manhattan in 200 Liberty Street, across the street from the Twin Towers, right by the Hudson River, and life was just perfect. And not too long after my arrival, there was a photo exhibit about conflict zones in a long crystal corridor, part of the 200 Liberty Street building. The corridor was overlooking at the Twin Towers, and the contrast between the pictures and their immediate surroundings made one wonder where those two walls intersected. The tragic attacks of September 11th showed that there was indeed a point of connection. At some point in the early 2000s, the Wall Street Journal also started running a series of articles about inequality. The articles made the point that social mobility was decreasing in the US and that the American dream was becoming more elusive. As you know, the increasing inequality in the US has been the subject of much debate in the last few years, but at the time there wasn't much discussion about it. As a foreign correspondent in the US, I was always surprised by the constant categorization of people. As I sometimes found myself wondering what box to check. I was born in Latin America and raised in Spain, so should I check the Hispanic female box or the European Caucasian one? Former President Barack Obama expressed that tendency well in a speech at the 2000 Democratic National Convention that gave him national prominence. During that speech, he said, "There is not a Black America and a White America and Latino America and Asian America. There is the United States of America." Looking back at many of the news events I witnessed and reported on as a journalist in the US in the last two decades, including the financial crisis of 2007 and 2008, I see now that what a big part of what made them possible was the perception of us being separate. A recent opinion piece by the New York Times titled "The Cities We Need" describes how American cities were the engines of the nation's economic progress during the first half of the 20th century, as well as objects of global fascination, admiration, and aspiration. There was racism, big profits by the elites, pollution and disease, but still, those cities offered opportunity. Then cities worked, now they don't, says the editorial piece published last month. The reason they don't is separation between enclaves of wealth and aging buildings and vacant lots where jobs are scarce and life is hard. And I'm quoting the article now. It says, cities continue to create vast amounts of wealth, but the distribution of those gains resembles the New York skyline. A handful of super tall buildings and everywhere everyone else in the shade. And the article adds, our cities are broken because affluent Americans have been segregating themselves from the poor, and our best hope for building a fairer, stronger nation is to break down those barriers. The separation that the article describes makes it easier to ignore problems and makes possible for those with most resources not to even see the problems. The affluent, the economist Joseph Stiglitz has written, have the best houses, the best educations, the best doctors, and the best lifestyles. But there is one thing that Manning doesn't seem to have bought, an understanding that their fate is bound up with how the other 99% live. I became an American citizen in Campbell, California, the summer of 2015. It was the same year I started coming to Canondo, where, contrary to what happens in much of the outside world, we learn through our Sasen practice that we are not separate, but one with everything. I have taken refuge in Dharma during the challenging times of this pandemic, and I would like to share with you, to end this talk, a Zen story I read recently. The story is about Master Nanzen, an 8th century Chinese master. He was asked by a monk, where will the master be gone to in 100 years' time? Master Nanzen replied, I will be a water buffalo at the bottom of that mountain. The monk then asked, may I follow you? And Master Nanzen said, if you do, bring a mouth full of grass with you. I love both the teacher and the student wanting to be with his teacher. You know, I did some research about water buffaloes and they work really hard, really hard. They work on rice fields, on muddy waters. They pull the plow or the cart through the fields. Their weight can reach 2,600 pounds. That has earned them the nickname of living tractors of the East. They're gentle enough to be milked, but they can also be aggressive and are not afraid to face tigers and lions, their natural predators. Master Nanzen's wish was to be a water buffalo, to practice in muddy waters, not abandoning any beings. I believe the water buffalo is a poetic image of the bodhisattva vow. I heard a Zen teacher say that Master Nansen is taking full responsibility from a life that is not separate from all beings. It seems so to me too. Thank you.
Thank you, Teresa. I'll now open it up for anyone who has a question. Dave?
So Teresa, you mentioned about the sort of mythical quality of upward mobility. And it reminded me of a book that I've just recently acquired. It has the rather whimsical title of The Sun Also Rises, where sun is spelled S-O-N. And but despite the whimsical title, it's actually a very serious analysis of the whole notion of upward mobility and the extent to which it actually exists. And the author's conclusion, backed up by some very careful research and analysis, is that upward mobility is pretty much a myth. And that it's largely supported by cherry picking of individual cases where you can find somebody who started out in poverty and ended up doing very well and having a lot of positive influence in society. But for everybody like that, you can find somebody else who started up higher and slipped down. And it's by this very selective attention to particular anecdotal details that we end up with this idea, this sort of Horatio Alger myth that if you keep your nose clean and work hard, that you will succeed. And of course, part of the problem with that whole idea is that it also implies the flip side, which is that if you're not doing well, then you must be a lazy good for nothing and it's only what you deserve, which is unfortunately the sort of dark side of the American ideal of upward mobility. Anyone can be president. Yeah, right. Just wanted to mention that book in case anybody's interested in drilling deeper into this whole question of social mobility and are people really kept down by their circumstances and their birth and so forth. There's a lot of good information around about that, and it's not sort of a Pollyanna story by any means.
Thank you, Dave. Can you repeat the title of the book?
It's called The Sun Also Rises, which is a sort of a play on the Ernest Hemingway book, S-U-N, Sun Also Rises, but in this case it's S-O-N, as in, is the circumstance of your birth going to dictate where you end up or not?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, the article I mentioned by the New York Times also has some interesting numbers. And among other things, it says that, in Chicago, for example, depending on what neighborhood you're born, your life expectancy the variation in life expectancy can be up to 30 years.
Travis?
Yeah, I just to add on to what Dave was saying, I definitely subscribe to that myth. I didn't come from much, and most of my elementary school class, all my classmates, a lot of the boys I went to school with in fourth, fifth, sixth grade, they're dead. They're dead or they're in prison. That weighs on me a lot. And, I don't know why I was able to get out of that or find my way into a life that I feel really fortunate to have. It's really a kind of process of experiencing something that's beyond you and that your struggle is worth something, and you then owe people the benefit of that story. So, I mean, for me, myths are the realest things there are. Because that's a kind of passed down wisdom. And the great stories have heroes. And, you know, there are things we can learn from this time, but I wanted to talk about the water buffalo because I think that you know, I've seen those water buffaloes when I was in Asia, and they're immense, you know, and I think we're like that and we don't know it, and we have this experience that we don't trust. And if we trusted our experience.
You're breaking up, Travis. I think we might have lost a connection with.
No, we will. And I think the ability to know and experience.
Oh, there you go.
Sorry, maybe I lost you there.
Yeah, we're back now. You're back now. It's great.
Yeah, I think the ability to know and experience on a beyond personal level is the kind of wisdom we need. And you know, we talk a lot about science and think science is going to solve our problems, but that's other.
Yeah, this connection's not very simple.
Water buffalo analogy.
We lost the last sentence, Travis. Sorry, you froze up again. Can you repeat the last sentence?
Probably Lucy's streaming something upstairs. But what I meant to say was that I think if we understand our experience, and we know how immense we are, like the water buffalo, that we're going to solve these problems we have, and it's just like the way that we can use science and the knowledge of other people's knowledge to advance the world technologically. I think if we could do that with our beyond personal experience, then I think we would be able to grow as a society and as a people, as a global community.
Thank you, Travis. I'm glad that the water buffalo story resonated with you.
Columbine?
Oh, okay. Am I unmuted?
Yeah, you're good.
Teresa, I was wondering, it's hard because for me personally, because I was born in America, so you hear about the American dream a lot. And for you, I wondered if you had a better perspective than me of what the pros and cons of the American dream. It seems to me that America is synonymous with capitalism, and I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing. Well, it's pretty much a bad thing. But at the same time, I don't know if, you know, other European countries have a better solution to that, or better balance. I mean, it seems that they do, but then at the same time, they're less maybe diverse, and I don't know if that solution would ever work in America.
Yeah, well, you know, I always had a sense of freedom in the US. I felt well since I arrived. Before coming to the US, I lived in Spain, obviously, and also in Romania and London. And I wasn't very happy living in London, but I was very happy living in New York. There was this sense of freedom and possibility. So I think that's what the American dream is about, a sense of possibility. But then, as I said, after living here for 2 decades now, I also encounter, you know, all the difficulties to, I mean, not on a personal level, but in general, as a society, all the difficulties to achieve that American dreams and the barriers that do exist while still keeping the same narrative. So I think it can lead to a lot of personal, maybe frustration or thinking that it is your fault, when I think more and more we are seeing that there are real things that make it more and more difficult to achieve that dream. I don't know about Europe. It's a difficult question. And, you know, I noticed that obviously in Spain, the social network is much bigger than in the US. So,
do you think that the American dream is an illusion that is causing more suffering than anything?
I don't know, but I do think, I don't know if it's an illusion. I do think it causes suffering for sure. But that's not to say that there's no opportunities at all. There are opportunities, but also things to fix and to make sure that we see the things that need to be fixed. You know, that we don't pretend that they don't exist.
Omar, you have a question? Hang on, let me unmute you.
There we go. Can you hear me?
Yes.
No, okay. So what I was saying was that I grew up in another country. I grew up in Pakistan. And I was telling Lee that today, that when I first went to get apply to go to the university, local university over there, you know, the first question they asked me was, where are my parents from? They didn't ask me if I was, if I had the national identity card. They asked me, where are my parents from? And what it was that, I said, they're from India. So, well, your quota is very small. I don't think we have space for you. So I was just thinking about this, and I was relating it to how African-Americans and people of other races have been treated in this country. And when you look at that very closely, you start to understand that you have been treated like this too, on the base of your, say, how you speak with an accent, or you're tall, you're short, you're up, you're down, you're left, you're right. I mean, you're big, you're small, you know, and you're pretty, you're ugly, you're, you know, handsome, you're whatever it is. There's some kind of a discrimination, but what it really comes down to is like, you don't look like me, you're not like me, so you don't have the right to be here. And that in itself is what connected for me with this, was like that we have, I mean, in this country, people, especially Black people, have been told that they've been here for the past 200 years, 300 years as slaves. They've gone through civil rights. You know, their leaders have been killed, but they're still being told that you don't belong here. And that in itself is what we all feel sometimes when we're a part of a group, or we go to high school, we go to university, and or we're a part of a clique, and somebody says, oh, you can't be a part of this clique because you don't look like us. This is wrong with you, and that is wrong with you, and you don't have this, and you don't have that. And that is a form of discrimination. And that's where the segregation comes from. So this whole idea in Buddhism that we are one, we're not separated from each other, it actually turns the whole idea on its head and says, no, there is no discrimination. You know, Buddha is in everybody, and you're like everybody. And when you're like everybody, you don't need to be discriminated against. You need to be respected. But this is the problem that I was seeing. It was just like, it came to me like, you know, flash of light. And I could clearly see it out of my own experience. It wasn't that I was locked into my experience, but I was just seeing very clearly how all of us can connect with that and feel what these people will feel, or anybody who has been ostracized or neglected feels. And that's where we need to come from. That is a real, real feeling. And that's what we need to connect with. And that's when we need to act from, is that this cannot happen anymore. We have to take a stand. Like Travis was talking about being the hero. This is what a hero says. He says, no more. I'm taking a stand. I'm going to do something about it. And that is the real hero. You know? So, you know, the people who get pushed up in society are the ones who are reality TV stars. That's where we stand. You know, that's where we are. Thank you.
Hernan, okay, let me.
Yes. Hi, Teresa.
Hi,
good to see you. It's good to see you, and thank you for your talk. And like the water buffalo, as a kid, I love oxen. So it's a good imagery. I wanted to make a couple comments. One is that as you, I came to this country, making a summary and not trying to make the comment based on my experiences, but my experience was very similar to you. This is a fascinating country with amazing opportunities. And probably I could say that I had the most exciting and moments and memories of my life, and also the worst ones and the biggest disappointments, both here. But that could be personal, so not to make it personal. I had talking about society and socioeconomic systems, I had the experience of living in Chile through two systems. When I was a kid, the system was basically like Europe, but poor. It was a poor country, very small country. And then Allende came, and then Pinochet came, and then we moved completely from center to left, and then to the far right. And the system that was imported into Chile was pretty much Milton Friedman and Reagan system. So what American system? Actually, it had been said that the most neoliberal country in the world have been Chile and the United States. So not thinking about here, but thinking about Chile, what I saw in that transition is that when I was a kid, there was more poverty. People had less dreams. People achieved way less. But we were closer, and we were more peaceful. We were more calm as a society. We were friendlier. After 25 years or 30 years, Chile progressed. It was like the jewel of Latin America. There's money, technology, amazing achievements for a country like Chile. And economic levels segregated. And Chile became more violent. People became more aggressive, more selfish, more individualistic. And tying this with what we practice or we try to learn and put in ourselves through Zen, which could be compassion, togetherness, thinking about others, doing no harm. If I think about that, I would say that the competitive capitalistic system that was brought to Chile, I would say that made the country worst, people-wise. And talking about here, I was very surprised in 1997, I volunteered for a search in the Tenderloin in San Francisco for a Thanksgiving. So I delivered food, turkey and other foods into those buildings. And I was surprised that the human misery I saw in those buildings, I never saw it in Chile. I couldn't believe it because it was people without hope, people you could see in their eyes, in their attitudes. Was a really sad life. And in Chile, when I was a kid, my father was a soldier, but my mother had a farm with workers. And my best friends as a kid, some of my best friends were the son of the workers. Some of them hardly have shoes. And I went to their homes and we went hunting together and riding horses together and playing on the hills together. And there was no difference as kids, even until we were 12, 13, 15. And today my sister is best friend with one of the workers' daughters. From that time, we all play together. You go to a farm today in Chile, and that does not happen. It's gone. Now it's the owner of the farm and the worker of the farm. And one thing this system brought to Chile, and is words that come all the time, is the word of winner and loser, which in this country also is applied a lot. And yesterday, talking with a friend from Chile who they haven't talked for a while, he made a comment that was was striking. He said, how surprising, he said. We brought the system from the United States, and last year, Chile got burned by the people, and now the United States is getting burned by the people. Could it be the system? That's what my friend said. And I don't have an answer for this, like you, but I wanted to share that because you made me think about the things. And as Zen practitioners, when I look at a society, the first thing I look is not success, but if there is togetherness, compassion, empathy, friendliness, that's what I wanted to say.
Thank you.
Thank you, Teresa.
I wanted to make a quick comment about what Tomar said about taking a stand. I think we, as practitioners, you know, we are taking a stand. That's taking a stand.
Thank you for your talk, Teresa. The Dharma has been a refuge for me too, and I agree both with you that as practitioners we take a stand, and with Umar about our country and making many people feel like they don't belong. I've been thinking a lot about this, and the past 6 months I've been taking a course. I'm still not good about talking about it. Because of the history of our country and our culture that discriminates against people and beyond making them feel like they don't belong, I think that Zen itself inherited some of that culture. And although it's not ever the intention, I think some of the outcome is that it hasn't been a refuge for everyone. And I think that it's important to acknowledge that. And I think as a community, during this time where we're thinking about this and hearing people, I think it's important that we make sure we look our centers and the Dharma, because they've always been, to me, the Dharma has never been in line with the American culture, and that's always been kind of confusing. And I think that we have a chance to really look at how we are in our Zen communities, and if we are always welcoming, and how we set things up to make sure that we don't make people feel like they don't belong unintentionally. And I think that's what I want to say about it tonight. But I just wanted to voice that. And yeah, I'd like to the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Anna. I think the Soto Zen Buddhist Association has been running some classes about whiteness in the Zen centers, right? I think you talked about it sometime last year. I don't know if that's something that you found useful.
I didn't take that course. I helped moderate one for the priests, which I think that they really enjoyed. And I just took a 6-month course on whiteness. And I took a 3-month course before that. That was really helpful to me. The 6-month course was on a Buddhist perspective of it. And it was run by a center that was kind of created for underserved communities, and was a center that people of color helped create the curriculum. And what a lot of those people were saying was that they didn't feel welcomed in a lot of sanghas. And to me, that was really important to hear. And I learned a lot through that. I can send resources to people if they're interested in that. But Zen in America has been very white, and there must be a reason for that. So I've been trying to understand more about that.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if, you know, even though we say we shouldn't intellectualize it, I think maybe there is a little bit of that. I wonder if that is a barrier of entrance.
I have just a quick comment on that as well. I think it's a reality that the socioeconomic realities affect people. I mean, how can people come to practice if they have to work 3 jobs, if they're pushed out of a community? So even if it's not the intention of, let's say, Zen community, the reality is that a lot of people can come to practice who can make the time to practice, who don't have to worry about, you know, their children starving if they're not going to be there, or and even in the priesthood, right? It's a big time commitment, and it's hard even for us. Then imagine how it could be for someone who doesn't have the same job opportunities or economic opportunities. So I think this is something we've scratched the surface on, where we're talking about how can we make Zen more accessible to people. And I think it's just hard. I mean, spiritual practice is hard when you're trying to worry about your own safety and food and basic things like that. So I don't have the answer. I think it's an ongoing conversation, but definitely just the socioeconomic disparity, it trickles down to everything. And we have to examine, are there ways in which we can kind of help to balance things more?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you, buddy.
Yes, Lee, let me unmute you, sorry.
I wanted to say that what we're talking about here is something that really, I've talked to, you know, to many people who, you know, who grew up. A lot of my cousins are older than my generation, and it seems like people were able in the 50s and 60s, even if they weren't high earning, they were able to live a decent life. You know, if a man had a job, he could support a family. They could find a place to live. It might not be a grand place to live, but they could find decent housing that was affordable for the wages that they made. And that slowly but surely has been eroding And at this point in time, you know, we have a society that's so focused on being super wealthy, you know, super important. Everybody wants to follow on Twitter the latest, you know, celebrity or whatever, and live and you know, dream of living their life. But we don't have the capacity to have, you know, a modest job and a modest home and a happy life any longer. It's gotten to the point where it's mostly the cost of housing that has become insanely out of proportion to the wages that people are able to earn. And plus, the system is really rigged against people who don't come from a higher socioeconomic background. The people who can send their children to the right prep school and can get their children into the Ivy League colleges and have connections to get them jobs and, you know, in legal firms or Wall Street or whatever it is that they're going for. So we really have experienced a huge growing gap of inequality and a lack of care about it in this country. I mean, even to the point where just before this big pandemic hit, they were talking about taking away people's food stamps, you know, because they should go out and work. It's not about people going out and working. The jobs that those people can get can't support them. So, you know, I feel as if there's this lack of, you know, maybe in some way, you know, if we can have any impact in this society, it's to show that it really does matter. If we really do need to care about people, and we really do need to help people who haven't got a way to get out of poverty.
So. Yeah. Thank you, Leah. I agree with that perception. You know, it seems that in the US right now, basic things that a family needs or a person needs, owning a house, taking care of your health, having health insurance, and sending your children to school are prohibitive. And, you know, related to Columbine's point, because there is this narrative of the American dream and this narrative about opportunities, if you don't achieve that, you think it is your fault, you know, because if you don't have it, it's because you're not resourceful enough. Or so, yeah.
Akash?
Hi, Teresa. Thank you for the talk. I actually went on a drive today to around San Jose in Japantown, and it was amazing to see so many businesses boarded up in what I assume is preparation for protests, and then also some businesses closing down completely, like packaging things. And I wonder, like, you talked about the aspect of the interconnectedness of Buddhism and how all we see when we're at home is what we see on the news. And if we go away from the news, then how we interact with the people that we're living with, if we are living with people. So like for myself, I live with my parents. And so, you know, I started to think on the drive, you know, if we're all, just intersecting or interacting with the people in our homes or seeing what we see on the news, and we're not really interacting in person with many people, if any, at what point do we say that we are, how can we reestablish our communities as well as better interact with new communities after this lockdown or quarantine ends? Thank you.
Can you repeat your question again? How we rebuild the communities?
how do we interact with new communities, or even interact with our, or re-engage with our old communities as well after this lockdown?
Well, that's a difficult question, but I think you mentioned something very important that you said, what is right with you? Who is close to you right now? You know, that I think I'm trying to focus on that. You know, I'm also living with my mother at the moment, and that's my reality. That's what's right with me, so I'm taking care of that. I think predicting what's going to happen after this lockdown is, wow, it's difficult for me. Maybe some other people have ideas. It seems that, yeah, there's going to be so many changes, at least temporarily, in the way we interact with each other. It's already visible every time we go to the streets or the supermarkets. People are afraid, so... It's changed quite a lot. I want to think that this is going to be temporary, and we will be able to become close to each other again. But yeah, it's difficult to predict. Maybe other people have some thoughts about that, about rebuilding our communities after the quarantine.
My first thought is, in order to rebuild our communities after the quarantine, we should do our best to maintain our communities during the quarantine. You know, the future is unpredictable, and staying connected, like, who do I know that is a good friend? What friends do I have? What communities do I have? Let's find some way to stay connected. Let's find some way to check in with each other. Because the future is unpredictable, and yeah, we're going to hope for the best and hope that it's going to just get easier from here out. But I think we can't put the pause button and just hope things get better. You know, we have to take action. And if that means going out, meeting one-on-one with a face mask to maintain a connection, or if it means making phone calls, I think we have to make that effort, not wait for someone to give us permission to value our relationships, make those relationships happen one way or another.
There's a lot of community services agencies that we can all get involved with and help them out by money, by time, making calls, doing things like that. And CSA is something that Teresa really knows really well, and she was also part of that. She can even tell you that we can all go and get involved in that, and we can help them out. There are ways of helping out, you know? Yeah.
I did reach out to a few African American friends and asked them, you know, are you okay? What can I do? Is there anything I can do? And the couple things they told me was just, check in on us. Like, if you have a African American friend, just say, hey, are you doing okay? Is there anything I can do? And they said, you know, in the past, people didn't even ask. We just had to show up to work the next day or take a sick day, and no one talked about it. It means so much just that you ask, am I okay? Really. And then another thing they said is that we can show support on social media or whatever platforms we have. Just show that we're an ally, that we care. Just show that we care, and that matters.
This is kind of something that when Lee was talking about the American dream shifting over the last half century or so, I thought about our expectations and if our expectations can change, and if we can prioritize having close-knit communities again, I think that that's one thing. And then I hope you understand, like, you can talk about the economics of of upward mobility on a micro level. And you can talk about the equality of opportunity versus equality of outcome, but you have to acknowledge, you know, this word's been used frequently recently a lot, the structural inequality, and that has changed. And that's very easy to study and understand. And so it's, you know, there's a little bit of nuance to this. And you know, I would like to encourage us to think about those partnerships with local charities that provide that opportunity for people to achieve and have enough and to have, you know, their version of that dream that I think a lot of us enjoy. And the knowledge of that lack of fairness just weighs heavy on our hearts, you know, and this is a time to really make those pledges have that resolution, that strong resolve to try to make a difference in whatever way we can.
Okay, well, thank you, Teresa, for this really, really caring talk and really thoughtful and inspiring and courageous, very courageous talk. So thank you, Manu.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.